It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
So you can tell us whether you think this might be an interesting series of podcasts, but Bruce and I have talked about this a little bit, and that's having one or more shows just dedicated to this issue, because it's come up with every one of our guests. And the thought was that we might have a group of professionals given their perspective, and then have a group of manufacturers give their perspective.
Yep.
Then get the two chief scientists from the RNA and the USJ, whose names escape me, who are into the bowels of the technicalities. Help us just sort of frame up the issues, right? What problem are you trying to solve? What are some of the potential solutions that you're considering? And give us the pros and cons of all that. And then bring in the administrators, you know, the guy running the USG and the RNA, and say, okay, here's our understanding of the issues. Here's what you guys are looking at. Where do you think this is heading?
I think that'd be very interesting. You'd have a great cross-section of interested listeners, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is not going to go away, and it's been brewing for a long, long time. Just ask Jack Nicklaus.
Yeah,
yeah, he's, really.
He's been railing for effect of the golf ball now for about 30 years.
You know, just a little button on all of that. A lot of it really started in the 80s when golf course developers trying to sell houses decided that, you know, maybe if there was another 50 yards of ground back there for a back tee, we could sell five or six more housing lots back there.
That's
and,
right. That's right.
You know, so par fours started to become 460, 475 or whatever. And anyway, I think that was a big part of the problem, not just the manufacturers or the administrators, but, you know, there was a big part of that with golf course architecture and development.
Talking about architecture, I know you've got a great interest in it. I just want to lead something off for you to take off on. When I first got involved in it, which was back in the 60s, our first angle point for a driver, before, like a dogleg right par four, it was 240 yards.
Yep.
And rightfully so, what you try to do is you try to build, you know, 18 par threes so that you're playing different shots, whether it be second shot, first shot at a par three, second shot at a four, or third shot at a five. Today, if you went out to build a golf course, what would your angle point be for the drive?
300.
So that's how much, that's really how much the game has changed. It's 60 yards at a minimum for your first angle point.
And you really do, if you're doing cart paths and designing the course for the scratch player, the professional player, say from 7,000 yards to 7,200 yards, your gold tee, if you will, your cart paths and your walking paths and whatever go to there. And then if you have the land, you then have a black tee 50 yards back for the young bucks and the tour players that can hit it 320. But most of the, you can't design it back there at 7,700. That has to be an addition, that extra 10% that you need for a tournament or for the tour players or the young, your college players. They actually, the guys in the Korn Ferry Tour probably average longer than the guys on the main tour, the young guys coming through. So it's made it very, very difficult with how you design the courses. But even from that 7,100 yard tee, if you will, it's still at 300, those turning points.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't design the cart paths around the black tee anymore. That's like an addition back there that only 1% of your players will ever use.
So you've done a little golf course design in your career. Are you still active with that?
I'd like to do more, but I don't have a big enough name to win the deals. I'm sure Bruce understands that. As the more and more Jack Nicklaus, at the time Arnold, obviously Gary Player, Greg Norman does a good job, gets a lot of work. The non-playing architects like Tom Fazio, now Gil Hartz, they're the ones that everyone wants. They're famous in that golf course architecture business, and it's hard to win. a contract against them, I've found. So as much as I was trying to do it up until about 10 years ago, the last 10 years it's been sporadic. It's been on an assistance type of format, yeah, rather than just going out to all of the shows trying to win the contracts. It's just too hard to beat the big money and the big names. And as much as I love it, if I had to give up everything in golf, Bruce, to take one angle and I knew I could get the work, it would be golf course, yeah, design. It's like raising a baby, yeah, isn't it? Sure it's is. Just you just nurture
it. It's a lot of work.
Good fun, though. Yeah. And you've done some great golf courses, some at home and some here. Yeah. I love up there in the Carolinas. You got your little baby up there that's just spectacular.
Yeah, we're getting ready to open again on September the 17th. We've been shut down for 3 months, so we're eager to get back at it.
Well, and you might be interested in this, Finchie. You'll get a kick out of it, I think. You know that Mr. Gonzalez was what I always call our president of the club down there, the benevolent dictator. I have an arrangement with Secession where nothing can get done to the golf course unless they get my approval for it. So, so when Mike retired, the new president said, "You know, you're getting along in age. You know, is there anything that you want to do to the golf course? You know, before you pass and before we dump you off the third tee?" And it was very interesting because we get back to the very subject that we just left a minute ago, you know, length of golf course. I don't think you need to do anything more. It's like you said, we can't build a black tee back there because you'd be 40 yards in the marsh and you can't do that. So we just leave it the way it is.
Good. That's the way it should be.
And now that I'm out of the role, Bruce has a spy here, so nothing happens without him knowing about it. Every little new pile of dirt that pops up, a little new mound, he hears about it. So let's talk about the Olympics. How did that all come up, you being the coach for the Australian team this year?
I was asked 3 years ago to relive the role I had done in 2016 in Rio, and that was a great honor to come back the first time in the modern Olympics to have golf back in as a sport back in 16. Unfortunately, it was Rio, which wasn't really a golfing mecca. They did build a wonderful golf course. Gil Hartz and his team did an unbelievable golf course down there. That was good fun and really enjoyed it. And I guess I did a good enough job that all of the golfing bodies back home in Australia, the ladies and the men and the pros and the amateurs, whatever, they all asked me to do it again. I suggested that they get Kari Webb to do the women's side and me to do the men's side. And Kari was still really, 3 years ago, a chance of making that team, you know, still playing well. She's a hell of a player, icon in Australia, obviously, in the world of golf. And she's going to do it. I shouldn't really let the cat out of the bag, but she's actually going to do it for both the men and the women in Paris in 2024. So I did it for both the men and the women again, this time in Japan. Japan's they're golf crazy there. It's a great golfing country. It was unfortunate we couldn't have fans because of the COVID, but it really was an honor to be selected to do it and to be a part of the team. And, hey, there's nothing I can do. I was like the architect of the environment, if you will. Make sure that everything that can be done for them to play at their best, that was done. I had most of the work was done by a couple of guys and a young lady back in Australia, Brad James, Matt Cutler, Stacey Peters. They were they did all of the work, the administrative stuff back from Australia and Golf Australia. And I just went over there as the captain and the team leader, the bus driver, the beer cooler, the whatever it was that needed to be done. that's what I did. But it was so, honestly, it was I'd do it all again the same. I just absolutely loved it.
So were you there from start to finish as far as opening ceremony, closing ceremony, or close?
Mm-hmm. the little insight, the opening ceremony was different this time, obviously, because of who was allowed to attend. But as the team leader, I would only walk in the opening ceremony or closing ceremony if my team wanted to do that. I didn't really want them getting in days or weeks early to do the opening ceremony and staying later for the closing ceremony. I wanted them to come in, treat it like a major, get there on the Monday morning or the Sunday night, treat it like a major, try and win it like you would a major golf tournament, and not really elongate that time spent, and especially this time with COVID. So we didn't walk either time, Rio or Tokyo. We didn't walk in the opening or closing ceremonies. We were there for the golf. We were there to perform at our best. We watched the opening and closing and afterwards the closing ceremony on TV when I got back to the States on tape. But we were there for the golf. We were there to win a medal for our country and do the best we could. Both the men and women did great. Actually, Cam Smith, had he birdied the last, would have won bronze outright.
That's right.
Had he parred, he would have been in that bronze
playoff.
I think it was a six-man.
Seven. What a playoff.
Yeah, he would have been eight. He bogeyed, unfortunately, going for the birdie. Hit it past the pin and three-putted. And then Hannah Green, the same. Had Hannah birdied the last hole, the 72nd hole, she would have been in the silver medal playoff. And she went for birdie, good honor, but unfortunately bogeyed and missed a medal by a shot. So both weeks we had a chance.
Yeah. So it's too bad that the timing doesn't work out where you're able to participate in one of those opening or closing ceremonies. But you're right. It probably affects a lot of athletes where they'd have to come in way early or stay way late just to participate.
Mm. And, to me, it was a hard one to suggest that they don't do it because I'm sure everyone wants to go feel that Olympic experience. And I probably had some negativity from others involved in the Olympic movement for my attitude towards it in suggesting that my team not do it, that they come in and be ready for the golf. But I felt that that was the best advice from everyone's perspective to come in and be ready to go, be ready to play. You know, the women would have had to have come in to Rio or Tokyo 11 days early to participate in the opening ceremony. Well, no, that'd be silly. Yeah. So anyway, you could still experience it. We experienced the spirit. I'll tell you what we did. We booked the hotel rooms 3 years ago. So we had enough hotel rooms. We had a couple of coaches, our Golf Australia people, myself, the two caddies, the two players in the hotel. And we booked a spare room that we took all of the furniture out except one of the beds. And we got a whole bunch of pillows and cushions around and a projector. And one of the guys from Golf Australia brought over on his computer Channel 7 from Australia, Channel 7 Plus or what it was called, 7 Plus. And each night we would play that on the projector on the wall of the hotel room.
Yeah.
So we all sat around the wall and on the bed and whatever, had a couple of cold beers and watched the Australian Olympic telecast, what people were watching in Australia.
Interesting.
And it was the greatest fun, mate. We had so much fun telling stories, remembering old times. And then the same one, the guys had gone, we did the same thing with the women's team. And young Minji and Hannah just had an absolute blast.
Yeah.
I'm sure. But it was very, very, very Australian, really a memorable week for all of us. I'm sure you could ask all of them when you get the chance to have them on the show.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I think we saw a few pictures on social media of your gang probably sitting on the pillows and watching. There were a few pictures posted. Sounds like great fun. And Australia had a great Olympics.
Yes, yeah. Pound for pound, we always win the medal count based on population. Obviously, we can't compete with the USA and China, and I think England were in front of us.
Yeah, they were.
But for 20 million people, we always do pretty well. And it's such a proud nation for sport, Australia. Really, really, really a proud sporting nation.
Yeah, yeah, great experience. A few general questions. Let me give you one career mulligan. Where do you take it?
Oh, it would have to be, I had a three-shot lead at the Australian Open in 1986 with two holes to play.
Ooh.
At Metropolitan. Roger Davis won. I finished second. I finished second in the Aussie Open three times. And I just somehow had a brain cramp on 17 and made triple and lost. I think if I'd have that mulligan now, I'd hit a 3-wood off the tee there, and I certainly wouldn't 3-putt. I'd like to have the Australian Open on my resume. It's the only big one in Australia I didn't win. So that'd be my mulligan.
Yeah, that's a good one. And you didn't have to think long to come up with that one either.
No, he came up with it immediately.
Some guys have to ponder that for a while, you know.
Well, as Bruce knows, as an Australian Open champion, Bruce knows it's a pretty special one.
And sure is.
As I said, I won all the other big ones, but that one, and three times second. But that one time I really should have won. I was playing great. Tomo was helping me out at the time, helping me with my swing, and I was swinging beautifully, and I just had a brain cramp and lost it.
Yeah. If you knew at age 20 what you know today, what would you have done differently?
Oh, boy. I certainly wouldn't have gone through the trouble I did with my driver, because I'd know now not to do it, and it's advice I've given to a lot of other young guys. And even on TV with Jordan Spieth, I said it a number of times, just stick with what you're doing. Don't change a thing. Keep your caddy, keep your coach, keep your girlfriend or wife, you know, whatever it is that you've been doing to get to a certain level. Don't change a thing. And we all go changing things because we want to get better. If you're not going forwards, you're going backwards. In all of the old, you know, great analogies to our game.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went searching, and that screwed me up, and I wouldn't do it now. I would I'd probably spend more time in the gym, knowing that the game became more about speed than it did about accuracy and touch. I used to spend a couple of hours every day of my life chipping and putting. I'd probably spend a couple of hours extra in the gym working on my speed, which is what they all do now.
Yeah. Let me take you through your golf bag. Let's just start with driver, and let's go in your prime, okay? Certainly pre-94, 95. Tell us about your driver. How would you rate your driving? And then tell us who you think the finest driver of the golf ball was you ever saw.
Oh, well, best driver of the ball when I was playing was Greg Norman. I was a very good driver. I was top 10 in driving accuracy, but I was 100th in driving distance. So my driving was good. I'd be a strokes gained driver in my prime, although I wasn't as long as I think I needed to be a multiple major winner.
Fairway Wood.
Fairway Wood, I was good. I was accurate. I had the distance control. You know, I was 230 in the air with a 3-wood, probably 220 with a 4-wood. I used to carry both. The best Fairway Wood players, I thought Tom Kite was pretty good with Fairway Woods. He was, you know, I'm thinking about that era of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah,
before, pre-Tiger, because – the best at all of them after Tiger was Tiger. So let's go pre-Tiger.
Yeah, that's right.
What about long irons?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it, because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Jack Nicklaus. Jack Nicklaus, Greg Norman. High, long, lot of power. Yeah, the guys that could hit it high and long, I thought, were the best.
And how would you rate your long iron game?
once again, I was good with all of my irons and stuff because I was so straight, but I wasn't, you know, two iron was 205 yards in the air. It wasn't like now where they'd hit it 260. I would say I was just average.
Yeah, let's go up to mid irons, six iron, five iron.
Who would have been the best at mid irons?
It's always a tough one to pick, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's, you know, that 150 to 200 yards you're sort of looking at, 140 to 200. Once again, Tom Watson was a pretty good iron player, I thought, and Tom Kite always, and Curtis, Faldo. Yeah, the guys that could control their distances. Johnny Miller, but he was, you know, I'm sort of going back a little bit for Johnny, but he was pretty good. And I was average. I was very straight with my irons, good iron player.
How about wedge play?
Wedge play, you got to go Corey Pavin, Tom Kite, Seve.
Good point.
Imagination, I'm going Seve. But then I'd probably, when you get to bunkers, I'm going to go Seve, Ballesteros, and Gary Player. I didn't play a lot with Gary. He's that much older than me, but Seve probably with bunkers. And I'm a very good bunker player, still am. I would say I'm top 10 bunker player of my whole life and pitching. But those guys were, I would look to them.
Did you have a Norman Von Nida bunker lesson at all?
We all had those. All of the guys that were taught by Von Nida then taught the next group, And don't you think, Bruce, the Aussies have always been very good bunker players because of
them? Fabulous. They've all been good bunker players, yeah.
Yeah. And I think the South Africans too, because of Gary. Gary may not have taught Louis Oosthuizen how to hit a bunker shot, but Gary taught, you know, all of the guys along the way. And
Norman had a big influence on him as well.
Yes, that's
right. I'm sure. Yeah. And so did the Arthur Lees from Sunningdale in England.
Yes.
Was another one that was Norman Von Nida's age and abilities back in England. Do you remember Arthur, the head pro at Sunningdale?
Oh, yeah, I remember him well.
Yeah, he was someone that was a great coach as well. And I think over here, Claude Harmon was one of the great American coaches, you know, Butch's dad and bunker player.
Yeah, what about pitching or chipping?
Yeah. Oh well, I kind of went there, didn't I?
Yeah.
Chipping Raymond Floyd. Sure, huh? Chipping Raymond Floyd.
Yeah. Floyd was awesome.
Best chipper in the world.
How was Trevino?
Trevino was great imagination, kind of unusual shots. But Raymond, he'd be 6 inches off the green. He'd never take the putter out. He'd chip it. He was awesome. Yeah.
And putter.
Putter.
Boy, hard to go past Jack.
Arnold was pretty good too.
Arnold, I didn't play a lot with Arnold in his prime. I didn't really see him when he was putting at his best. He was a bit older, but yeah, the guys that win multiple majors, I think you've got to put down as the best putters because they get it done under pressure.
How about Dave Stockton anywhere around the green?
Yeah, Dave Stockton was brilliant in his own style, but and he proved it. Went into the Champions Tour, Bruce, and putted great.
Yeah, and Spieth.
Spieth now, yeah.
Well, then you Rahm. Skipped over Tiger.
Well, I left Tiger out because Tiger was the best at everything. Honestly, if you every one of those categories, I'm going Tiger.
Yeah, you could, for sure.
Who's in your dream foursome? Who's you and three other players? Who living or not with us? Who would you play with?
I've got to go with the big three. They were the guys that got me involved in the game and why I've had such a great life in golf.
Yeah,
you know Jack, Gary, and Arnold.
That's pretty good threesome.
There's a lot of guys my age that would have to thank them.
What's on your list that you still want to play? There's probably a lot of great courses around the world that maybe you haven't had an opportunity to play. What's your short list?
There's a lot of new courses that I haven't had a chance to play, obviously, but I've played probably 200 of the world's 250. That's my love, a passion. I go everywhere to play. I'm going up to Banff in a couple of weeks' time to play a couple of lovely courses up there in mid-September. I haven't been to Brookline, the country club. I haven't played that. I'm going to try and play that sometime. That's an open venue I haven't played.
Great history there, yeah.
You'll enjoy that. You'll enjoy it.
How about in the UK? What are you missing in England? Let's just focus on a country. Anywhere in England that you need to get to?
I've been told Ganton is a great course that I haven't had a chance to play. I've played all of the great courses around Sunningdale. A couple of years ago, I went and spent 10 days and played all of them. In the north, any in England I haven't played that I know. In Scotland, I'd say I haven't played Nan. Yeah. I've heard Nan is really nice. I've been up to Inverness and played up there. I didn't play Nan. I've played them all in Ireland. There's one in Ireland I haven't played, the Island Club in Dublin. I've heard that's, Clarkie told me that's really special, the Island Club.
I'm going over there at the end of the month. I'm going to play Tralee and Hogshead.
Mm-hmm.
Played Hogshead?
Hogshead.
Yeah, that's a fairly new one.
You haven't played Hogshead. Old Head I have, the one on the island. That's, yep, that's a great place to take your camera. The course isn't great, but it's a beautiful spot.
Yeah.
There's some wonderful golf. Ireland's so friendly too. I love going there. Good fun.
Yeah, COVID's just kind of put a little kink in the works here this year, trying to get over there. I know Bruce is heading over there early October. We're heading over in 10 days, so we'll a little bit in Ayrshire and a little bit in London and, you know, down Sussex. Actually going to play 5 open rota courses this trip.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Which ones?
Well, 3 of which are no longer. And so up in Scotland, Prestwick, which was the first, mm-hmm, obviously. And then we're going to play Turnberry, which I haven't played since they fixed it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then down in Kent, of course, you know, those 3 courses right there together. You got Prince's, mm-hmm, which hosted it many, many years ago, as did Royal Cinque-Ports, Deal,
mm-hmm.
And then Royal St. George's.
Beautiful. Take the channel over to Paris while you're there. If you haven't done it, that's a great experience. It's only 3 hours in the train Paris.
I've taken my rental car through the channel years and years ago.
Oh,
which is kind of weird, right? Because you rent the car and you're driving on the correct side of the road for an American in France. And you come out of the tunnel and, whoa, what are we doing here?
Whoa, I know. That's really weird. We took the train instead of a car there. But yeah, that's a great trip. That's good fun.
Yeah, yeah. It's we've got, I think we're there 11 days, play golf every day, and should be a good time. So
make sure you get a massage every 3 or 4 days to allow you to keep going for 11 days straight. People don't realize, do they, Bruce? No. You bloody walk every day on that hard ground.
Yeah.
That is a great tip, and that's what we do every 4 days or so, because, you know, there'll be some 36 days sprinkled in there, and mm-hmm, that's about the only way you're going to make it.
Yeah.
Yeah, good on you.
It's tough sledding. Any superstitions? Any special numbers you played? Things you carried in your pocket? Ways you marked your ball? Any of that?
Yeah, I always used my fours. The balls used to come in a dozen, and in the old days they were numbered 1 to 12. But in modern times, they were a sleeve of ones, twos, threes, and fours. I always used the fours in practice rounds. And I use ones, twos, and threes in the tournament. And I always tried to use ones on the last day because I wanted to finish first. Yeah. I used to mark it with a pencil, 2 dots underneath the number. I used a 1967 10-cent piece for years and years as my marker. I felt 67 wasn't asking for too much, but it was a pretty good score to shoot each day. So that was my goal.
That's great. I love it.
And, you know, some guys would refuse to call those superstitions more like just routines, yeah?
I think so. John Cook told me once he had four white tees and one marker in his right pocket, and that's what he always had. That was his deal. Some people have a special marker or a memorable marker for whatever reason. But we're all a little bit on the spectrum, I think, when we come to professional golf. Yeah. We're all very, you know, we're on that line all the time of, everything has to be perfect. Type A is what I mean when I say that. It's like we're all very, very conscious of routine and, you know, iron our shirts correctly each time, arrive at the course the same time. You know, it's a precision sport.
Well, Ian, thank you very much for your time today. You've been so generous to Bruce and I with your time, both our first visit and this visit. We've covered a lot of ground with your career. Of course, there's a lot of great things to talk about, which we did. And we sure appreciate you being with us.
I've loved being with you every minute, guys. Thank you so much.
I just want to add that we haven't seen the last of you, Finchie. We get a chance to watch you on CBS television, and you've had a wonderful career there. And like Mike said, we really appreciate you coming and talking with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Bruce, always great to be with you, mate. You're a great role model for all us young Australians coming through in the 70s. We watched you with great interest and joy, and wish you and the family all the very best. Keep doing what you're doing. Your show's great. A lot of loyal followers.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.